From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
A woman's right to choose. Is the battle over? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Despite 35 years of cultural warfare, Roe v. Wade is still the law. Voters have elected a pro-choice president. Anti-abortion initiatives fail at the polls. The pro-life movement won't go away, but it's changing its tactics. Today, we'll hear about the search for common ground and a new issue, same-sex marriage.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
We're only back with To the Point. Since Roe v. Wade was decided 35 years ago, a woman's right to choose an abortion has been issue number one in the so-called culture wars, but it's still the law. The next Supreme Court vacancies are likely to be filled by a president who is pro-choice, Barack Obama. Ballot initiatives to limit abortion failed this month in South Dakota, Colorado, and California. Is the battle over? Cynthia Gorney is author of Articles of Faith, a frontline history of the abortion wars. She's also a professor of journalism at UC Berkeley, and as you might have gathered from the sounds we just heard, we have lost her for the moment. We will get her back. How are we doing on her? Cynthia Gorney, we have other people online, and she's still not there. Well, let me go first then to Nicholas Cafardi, who is a Catholic scholar, canon lawyer, author of Before Dallas, the U.S. Bishop's Response to Clergy Sexual Abuse of Children. Mr. Cafardi, good to have you on our program.
Good to be here.
It is being said that the battle is, for the reasons I enumerated earlier, if not over, then in need of change. What's your take? Has the legal struggle over abortion been lost?
I think if it has, in the following sense, that even if Roe v. Wade were to be overturned, all that happens is that it sends the question back to the states, the individual states. And there are a number of states, the last time I looked, over 20, who had already passed abortion protection laws, and a couple who had interpreted their own state constitution to guarantee that a woman's right to an abortion, which means that when it goes back to the states, if Roe were overturned, we would have it perhaps highly regulated in some states, less regulated in others, and perhaps illegal in a few. But it will not end abortion in the United States.
Again, Nicholas Cafardi is a Catholic scholar and canon lawyer. He is, has written about the U.S. Bishop's response to the clergy sexual abuse of children, as well as dealing with the subject we're discussing. Cynthia Gorney is back with us once again, journalism professor at UC Berkeley and author of A History of Abortion Politics. And, Professor, good to have you on our program. Let me just ask you now to give more of an umbrella look at this. You're pretty neutral on the whole issue. We just heard Nicholas Cafardi say that from a legal standpoint, it doesn't look like abortion is going to be ended. So what's next?
I agree with Mr. Cafardi, and I think that the round of votes that took place in this last election further confirmed what people had been wondering about. I don't know, in the time that I was there in the radio vortex, I'm not sure whether you talked about the election and the fact that abortion-restricting measures of various kinds were voted down in three states this fall. My guess about what's next is that right-to-life people who have been trying so hard on this matter for a long time are, to a certain extent, going to go back to the drawing boards and are going to concentrate. I don't have any inside knowledge in this regard, just based on years of talking to people about these things, that what they're going to concentrate on now is trying to restrict the number of abortions that take place and the circumstances under which they take place by coming up with new laws and approaches that might be accepted within the current framework of Roe v. Wade. And there are a variety of strategies in that regard that we can talk about. But I agree that the prospect with an Obama administration for the next 4 years, the prospect of any kind of an overt overturn of Roe is gone, and that people on both sides are probably sitting back and going, all right, we are starting to approach something that looks a little bit like consensus in this extraordinarily divisive issue.
So what are these new strategies, though?
Well, there are a variety, and they're going to be tested one by one. There are an increasing number around the country of laws that right-to-life people describe as informed consent laws and abortion rights people describe as mandatory or coerced statement laws that basically prescribe, from the state's point of view, what a doctor or a health practitioner must say when the abortion is about to take place, that mandate waiting periods of various kinds. To my particular eye, one of the most interesting examinations of this question is underway right now in Oklahoma, where there was recently passed an omnibus abortion bill that included among its provisions a requirement that any woman obtaining an abortion in Oklahoma be required, not offered, but required to have an ultrasound. And the bill language itself actually states that while the woman is having the ultrasound, the doctor is supposed to describe what he or she is seeing on the ultrasound. In other words, women are being obliged to confront, as literally as is possible to do so, the visual idea of what it is that they are aborting. And the law is being challenged. The law actually contains, interestingly, a provision in its own language that says that the woman may avert her eyes if she wishes. It doesn't say anything about whether she can plug her ears and sing loudly during the whole thing. And so the question, of course, that arises, it's being challenged, it's being litigated by litigators who are practiced at this sort of thing from the abortion rights community. And whether that is upheld will be one step in all this. So from the right to life perspective, I think one of the, as I indicated before, they're going to try for more intensive forms of what they describe as informed consent. In other words, forcing women who are having abortions and physicians who are performing abortions to characterize the procedure in a certain way so as to make the women think more about the abortion as the ending of a human life rather than as a decision that they are making, which is what the abortion rights people are after. Second, I would assume that there's going to be an uptick in what I would call, you know, public persuasion efforts, public education, propaganda, whatever you want to call it, to continue encouraging people to think of abortion as a morally awful act and one that should at all costs be replaced by other actions. In terms of legislation, I'm not sure what else. There's a set of laws that are shorthanded as TRAP laws, targeted restrictions on abortion providers, which are municipal or other kinds of laws, building codes, and so on, that are written in such a way that the abortion providers themselves are the only people who are really affected by them. Your hallway has to be a certain width. You have to have X amount of emergency equipment in your outpatient clinic, et cetera. Those have been implemented with some success, overturned in some places, but used again as a legislative vehicle for cutting back on the delivery of abortion services without explicitly cutting back on a woman's right to abortion. So strategic efforts like that that come around the edges, I would assume, are going to be part of the plan for the next while.
Cynthia Gorney, again, a professor at UC Berkeley, author of Articles of Faith, A Frontline History of the Abortion Wars. Nicholas Cafardi, let me go back to you, our Catholic scholar, canon lawyer. Does that sound right to you?
Well, there's always been action in the areas just mentioned in terms of informed consent laws, in terms of waiting periods, and the Supreme Court has upheld them as long as they don't impose what the court calls an undue burden on a woman's right to an abortion. I am a right-to-life person. You know, laws restricting the availability of abortion don't bother me. But I think we have to realize that they're not the best way to deal with the issue. I think the best way to deal with the issue is to provide help to the woman who's in the situation who might choose an abortion. I mean, right now we have a society that doesn't provide adequate health care or income support to poor pregnant women, so that whenever they're forced to, into a situation, they make the tragic choice of abortion. That's completely apart from whatever the legal structure is. I don't see the legal structure as solving what is basically a moral problem. I think and a societal problem. I believe that the best way to approach this issue is to not so much try to make abortion unlawful, though again, pursuing that goal would not be inappropriate to my way of thinking. But I think it would be better to try and make abortion unacceptable unthinkable and unnecessary because, again, we're providing the kind of support that a woman faced with that choice needs not to make that choice.
In the issue, on this issue of making it unnecessary, to what extent is there resources available? Are there resources available to provide help to women who might choose abortions? Are we now talking about numbers, and do you make certain kinds of assistance available to women who choose abortion but not to others? How do you make the appropriate distinction?
Well, you know, the way to provide the assistance, of course, is to provide it across the board to women who are poor and pregnant, and again, adequate health care.
So it just be a much broader approach then?
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, I've always thought that the root problem of abortion hasn't been its legal availability as a medical procedure, but it's the reflection of a socially and morally bankrupt society that makes abortion a desirable alternative for too many poor women. So government policies that will seek to eradicate that bankruptcy will cause a lot fewer abortions.
Nicholas Cafardi again, Catholic scholar and canon lawyer. Tom Minery is a vice president of public policy at Focus on the Family, one of the very well-known groups that involved in the Right to Life movement. And Tom Minery, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate the discussion today.
Do you agree that the legal battle is all but lost as far as getting rid of Roe versus Wade is concerned?
Oh, well, I think those are two things. No, I don't think the first of all, the legal battle is lost by any means. There are a number of states that have informed consent laws on abortion. 36 states have laws that require parental involvement.
All right, we know that. But what about Roe versus Wade and the right to abortion generally?
Well, the first part of your question was, is the abortion fight lost? No,
okay.
I think we're making incremental gains back from where we were in the wake of Roe v. Wade. And in our way of thinking, the fight against Roe v. Wade can never be lost, even though we have setbacks. And the reason is that we believe that abortion is the taking of an innocent, unborn human life, and that can never be made acceptable to society. And we are very encouraged overall. The public seems to be getting slowly more pro-life. People want limits on abortion. People are not advocating unrestricted abortion. And in that connection, from what we know about President-elect Obama, it seems that he's a bit out of step with that slowly growing majority in the country. And obviously, we may have a setback in the Supreme Court. However, if in fact two of the more liberal members of the court resign and are replaced by two equally liberal members, we haven't, from the pro-life side, we haven't lost anything yet. So, no, this election has been a disappointment from the pro-life point of view, but by no means have we given up the fight, or by no means have we said that we have lost.
I don't think Nicholas Cafardi said he was giving up the fight either. What do you think about this broader approach of helping poor women who might choose abortion because of their situation in life?
Oh, well, it's wonderful, and Focus on the Family advocates that completely. We started several years ago a program to place ultrasound machines paid for by our donors in pregnancy resource centers around the country, and the number of women who have made use of those and who have decided to bring their babies to term is probably 60,000-70,000 now as a result of the several hundred machines that are in place. But we take this all back one step further, and we advocate for the traditional family. You know, the statistic that makes women into poor women is the breakup of the home. When a marriage ends in divorce, usually it's the woman without the life skills, job skills, and stuck with the kids. She's the one whose income drops precipitously, and the kids are suffering. So we take it back beyond abortion to the need to restore the nuclear family.
Again, Tom Minery is Vice President of Public Policy at Focus on the Family. Walter Dillinger is with us. Want to get one more voice into this conversation. A partner at the law firm O'Melveny & Myers. He was Assistant Attorney General, later Solicitor General in the Clinton administration, has argued before the U.S. Supreme Court on these and other issues. Walter Dillinger, good to have you on our program.
Thank you, sir.
Do you think that it's time for people who are pro-choice to be complacent?
No, I don't. I think it's been an excellent discussion, and I think the observations are all to the point. But I think the promise of Roe versus Wade, which was that every woman could make and effectuate the reproductive choices that shaped her life, has never been met, and that we are a long way from women being able to make those reproductive choices. The absence of the exclusion of funding for abortions and other reproductive health services, the parental involvement laws, which burden young women, and particularly the so-called intermediate restrictions of waiting periods or mandatory counseling sessions, really tend to price and regulate abortion beyond the reach of the most vulnerable women, those who are hostage to poverty, youth, and geography. We are sort of moving into a two-tiered system where affluent women in major metropolitan areas have access to choice, but the most vulnerable women, for example, a 17-year-old teenager in rural North Carolina who may never have been out of the county in which she was born, for someone like that, a waiting period, a 24-40-hour waiting period or a separate mandatory counseling session means two trips across the distance of a state or an overnight stay in a strange and distant city. We're really, I think, taking away choice from those young women, and more provider availability has become the Achilles heel of reproductive choice. There are fewer and fewer providers available. So for all those reasons, I think that we are a very long way from women having the right to really fully exercise the choices that shape their lives.
Let me go back to Tom Minery at Focus on the Family. You said it would be a wonderful thing to help poor women. What about helping them get the rights that they are, in fact, entitled to by virtue of this decision that they have the right to abortion under Roe versus Wade?
Well, first of all, let me say that there is a wide range of pregnancy resource centers dedicated to sanctity of human life that see women, abortion-minded women, day in and day out. And those centers provide an array of help for women in terms of pregnancy clothing and diapers, mother care understanding, and even networks to provide continuity so she has some hope of financial security during the time that she's without a job, and help getting work. And all this is done through religiously based organizations, religiously motivated organizations, all done with private money. And the idea that this is one more problem that we've got to dump on the federal government, and if we don't do that, it will not be solved, that's rather myopic, I believe.
But the religious organizations don't provide the kind of help that Walter Dellinger is talking about to women who might choose to have an abortion, but don't have one the resources to get one immediately available.
Well, I'm not sure if you're trying to get me to say that I support women being able to have abortions paid for. I certainly do not.
I'm sure you don't.
We think abortion is a great evil. So I must have misunderstood your question.
Well, what I'm saying is, and Walter Dellinger, maybe you can say it better than I can, that there are two ways of helping poor women here, and it seems to me there's a real conflict.
Well, yes, I think the point is, and I certainly understand the perspective of Focus on the family, but from someone who really believes that this is a critical part of a woman's autonomy to make these decisions, that having sort of one-way funding does not effectuate that. Now, it seems to me the two other issues that need to be put on the table are the fact that missing from the discussion about how to reduce the number of abortions without engaging in coercion of women is greater contraceptive availability, contraceptive education, and making condoms and other contraceptives widely available would, without any doubt or dispute, drastically reduce the number of abortions. Now, I think opponents of that obvious measure for reducing abortions will say that it will marginally lead to an increase in sexuality outside of marriage. But think about the equation that we're making then. It's no longer evolving human life that is justifying compulsory pregnancy and childbirth. It is a desire to marginally avoid an increase in people having sex. But that's hardly a justification for this intrusion into a woman's life. If you could spare the actual killing of children by a few people being marginally more inclined to have sex, surely you would do it. So it really calls into question, I think, the legitimacy at some level of opposition to abortion when people are unwilling to take the most simple and effective step of reducing the number of abortions, which is to provide more availability of education and contraception itself.
Mr. Minery, do you want to comment as quickly as you can on that? I want to change the subject to politics, but it's a pretty important point.
Yes. Well, my problem with the statement just made is that it's the same one that a lot of pro-abortion people use, that just we need more condoms. We need more condoms. I don't know if anybody's ever read the federal regulations regarding the proper use of a condom, proper storage at proper temperature, proper application, proper unrolling, proper disposal. We've all had teenagers in the home, and it's hard to remember to get them to take the trash out once a week. And proper use of a condom in the backseat of a car on a steamy Saturday night is not something that a lot of kids are going to do accurately. And I'm just absolutely mystified by the bias against abstinence education, which is a fact-based, scientifically reviewed programs dealing with the fact that the best kind of sex is sex within marriage, and the delay of sex is the safest for everyone.
All right. Obviously, a lot of issues arising here as we try to talk about this very, very complex question of abortion. We're going to take a very brief break, then come right back.
For more information about To The Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/To The Point.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. Once again, talking about abortion, I do have to make the point that Cynthia Gorney is the only guest on our program who is a woman, and it is a question of women's rights that we are debating, the rest of us being men. Having said that, Cynthia Gorney, what about the political situation, and will we see a change there, the Republican Party having stressed for so long the effort to get rid of abortion and specifically to repeal Roe versus Wade?
Well, I'm going to take issue with one of your central premises in a sort of counterintuitive way, which is that I actually believe there is some substance to the fairly cynical statement that Roe v. Wade was the best thing that ever happened to the Republican Party. Because it provided, of course, an ongoing organizational device and allowed lots of politicians to loudly proclaim themselves to be pro-life, therefore courting the pro-life vote without ever knowing that they would then have to take the subsequent step of actually outlawing abortion in their own state because the Supreme Court said it couldn't be done. So I think one thing that may happen now is a sort of a realignment in who declares what kinds of allegiances. I don't think, frankly, that abortion is going to be very high on the Republicans' to-do list for the next while. I do think that there is, as I said, going to be this going back to the drawing boards to figure out how this can be made strategically useful. I think my personal opinion, and I don't know whether I'm right or wrong about this truly, is that gay marriage is going to replace abortion for a relatively short period of time as a rallying cry for organizations like Focus on the Family and others, which want to use social controversy as a means of promoting their own agenda. And I have been asked by people whether I thought gay marriage would have the kind of staying power that abortion has as an issue that truly arouses deep passions in people. And my personal opinion, which I have to say is partly based on hope and my own personal predilections in this regard, is that it will not. That 10 to 15 years from now, opposition to gay marriage is going to look like opposition to interracial marriage looked 20 years ago. I could be wrong about that. I think that the abortion fight is a very different one and is genuinely based on people's personal belief that lives are at stake. There's one other point that I wanted to throw out, which is a little bit off the political end of it, but that I think is important, Warren, for people to think about in terms of what comes next. I believe that one of the central public arguments that is going to be carried out over the next few years as the Roe v. Wade overturn question goes away, at least for the time being, is the one that both Mr. Cathardi and Mr. Minari were referring to. I think one of the central problems that Right to Life is going to want to be grappling with and probably will need to confront, there is going to be a line of argument that we will hear more and more in coming months, which basically says women have abortions because they're forced to, because societal conditions make it impossible for them to raise a child, and it is always a tragedy, and they always wish afterward that they had not done so. We're going to hear a lot more about post-abortion syndrome. There was language to this effect in the last major Supreme Court ruling on abortion coming from Justice Kennedy, striking down the partial birth abortion ban, as the federal government called it. Striking down the opposition to it. And what we're going to be hearing is people saying it's always a bad thing for women's psyches, and we are going to have to sort of, as a society, confront the fairly substantial number of women, not all by any means, who have abortions because they don't want to carry the child, not because they're unable to, not because they are oppressed by their husbands, but because they have decided that there's a different path that they want to take right now. And how we think about those women and how we talk about them over the next few years, I think, is going to be a real focus of discussion and argument.
We have less than a minute left in this program, and so I'm not going to ask either Mr. Cafardi or Mr. Minnery to respond directly to that. I know that Mr. Cafardi said earlier, and I believe Mr. Minnery seconded it, that there is going to be an effort to educate, if that's the appropriate term, women about abortion. Let me leave it at that. But Tom Minnery, very quickly, will Focus on the Family be focused also on this issue of gay marriage?
Well, we have been. We've been rather heavily involved in all of the 30 states which successfully passed state marriage amendments, and will continue to be.
Will it replace abortion in any sense?
Oh, it cannot. Abortion is a taking of an innocent, unborn life, and that remains a priority issue.
Okay. And Mr. Cafardi, same question to you very quickly, if I can.
I have absolutely no idea. I really couldn't project that. But I just think it's a mistake to let the politicians use the social wedge issues for their own advantage when they actually have absolutely no real interest in solving the problems.
Okay. Thank you all very much for being with us. Complex issue. We'll never be finished with this conversation. Nicholas Cafardi, Tom Minnery of Focus on the Family, Walter Dillinger, former Assistant Attorney General and Solicitor General, Cynthia Gorney at UC Berkeley, Articles of Faith, A Frontline History of the Abortion Wars. Today's program produced by Sonia Geis with Christian Bordahl and Karen Radziner, our technical director, Mike Newport. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.